Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. My name is Peter Matthews, and we're here live at Firehouse World in sunny San Diego. And today we're doing a chiefs panel. A few chiefs from the area have been nice enough to come out and spend the afternoon here at the San Diego Convention Center. We have Chief Gary Fisher, Augie Gio, and Kim Raddatz. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me, and I'd like to get a few bits of information about you and your department before we get going. Gary, can you tell me about your background in the fire service and your department's makeup?
34 years in the service, 12 years as a fire chief. Originally from Missouri, migrated to Arizona and ended up out here in California for the last 5.5 years. Department is a mid-sized department, 100 people, 6 stations, very busy department, run over 10,000 calls a year.
Okay. And Augie Gio.
Yes, in my 33rd year in the fire service, not quite up to Gary, but I'll catch him next year, maybe. I retired from the city of San Diego and then took a job as the fire chief out in the San Miguel Consolidated Fire Protection District a little over 3 years ago. We are a large fire district. We have about 124,000 people. We deal with about 48 square miles in eastern San Diego County. And we just recently completed one of the successful consolidations, which we're very proud of, with the East County Fire Protection District. So we're very much in favor of those types of things, and we're hopefully going to be continuing to be a progressive fire department.
Okay, and Chief Kim Raddatz.
Like everyone else, I have over 30 years in the fire service. I'm going on, like Augie, my 33rd year. Started with Cal Fire in the 70s, and then spent a lot of time in East County of San Diego County, and then been the fire chief for the city of Coronado for the last 5 years. We're a relatively small city in the city of Coronado. 2 stations, 30 personnel a day, very high tourist population on Coronado with the Hotel Del, and a very affluent, high socioeconomic neighborhoods, and run right at about 2,500, 3,000 calls a year.
Okay. All right, Chiefs. Well, thank you very much for joining us here today. One of the first questions we'll go into is something that's affecting everyone across the country with the economic problems and situations that we're running into. How are you guys maintaining your level of service in your respective departments based on reduced budgets? And I know I'm sure every week there's a new potential cut coming around the corner, but how do you maintain your level of service and keep it at the same level no matter what budget crisis you're facing?
Well, I guess I'll go first. At this point, I think we're doing all right. We are keeping it at the same level because we're really trimming up what little bit of excess fat that we have in the budget, cutting down on training issues and training trips, and cutting down on some maintenance things. And so right now, we're whittling away at the edges. But, you know, I think there comes a point where cutting out certain services in the fire department do have an effect on the community, and you really can't help but have an effect on the community. Mm-hmm. We just laid off 3 prevention personnel, and that relates directly to the fire prevention services that we provide out in the community. So I mean that's going to hit us, and as time goes on, depending on how bad this economy gets, we may be looking at firefighters and paramedics. So I think there are a number of things that I think we can do. I think once you can take advantage of regionalization, we use that extensively right now, where we have automatic aid agreements across jurisdictions, essentially no borders, and that really helps to maximize the efficiencies of both or all of the departments that are engaged in that, and you just send the closest unit. That helps a lot. I think that you can also help yourself a little bit with priority dispatching kinds of protocols in the dispatch center, where you prioritize the calls as they come in and focus on the most important ones. But I think there will come a point in this economy where it will affect the community, and people will see a difference in what we're doing out there.
Okay. Thank you, Chief.
Yeah, I agree with Gary. In San Miguel, we're fortunate. And this is my first experience in a fire district after working for a large municipal for most of my career. But we belong to two joint powers authorities, which helps us contain our costs. One is for training services. The other one is for and actually a training facility. And the other one is for dispatch services. So those types of functional consolidations really do help, like Gary was talking about. But I do agree with them. I don't think it's a matter of if services are going to be effective. Services are going to be effective. I think it's right around the corner. As a fire district, we're primarily funded by property tax revenue, and that is dropping like a rock in San Diego County. We're going to be looking at possibly a $1.3 million budget drop, a revenue drop next year. So some of the things we've been doing is working and partnering with our labor organization. We're just finishing up negotiations where we're going to be, where voluntarily our three labor groups have given back some of their benefits. We're going to have to continue to look at those things if we're going to keep the same level of service without bringing in new revenue. The other thing that we're looking at right now, and there's never a perfect time for this, is a service benefit fee. If you want to maintain or even improve services, you've got to bring in new money. Because you can't print it. You're going to have to find out where it's at. And it's really going to be the citizens who are going to have to pay for the service if they agree to it, if they believe that the value is there. And I think that having those sustainable funding sources is probably the primary way that we're going to be looking at maintaining our services. Or, I'll be honest with you, I think within the next 6 to 9 months, we'll be reducing services. We have no other choice. I think long-term, what fire service across the country is going to have to look at is looking at two-tier systems. We're going to have to look at the long haul. This is probably going to be a 3 to 5 year recessionary trend. And in order to look 5, 10, 20 years out the road, as fire service managers and leaders, we're going to have to get our elected officials to come to grips with labor and say, is this the time we pull the trigger on two-tiered systems for medical and retirement benefits? It's hard to afford what we've done over the past 30 years in this kind of a down market. But I agree with Gary on the other thing, is that we've got to continue to pursue functional and full consolidations, and that's another way to average out and provide a high level of service in a cost-effective manner. So those are some of the things. And the last thing that I've got to say on this is I think we've also got to look at looking at different service models. One of them being the old Gage and DeSoto model from the 1970s television series. And that's where you have a medic rescue squad, which is about 83% of what we do in my district. And maybe it's not a 24-hour shift. Maybe it's a 10-hour shift during peak demand, sort of like a ambulance unit hour utilization. So I think we got to look outside the box if we're going to maintain the existing level of service. There's no one answer. There's going to be a multitude of answers out there.
You know, I agree with the fact that if we don't do something, in fact, we're going to be forced to do something just surely by the economics. I do, however, think that as a fire service, what we need to be is incredibly proactive on our approach to how we do things. And if the economy is going to start to go bad, I think we have an obligation to first look at the dynamics, demographics of our community. And then we need to look at an organizational analysis of the services we provide. And then, in fact, see if the services we provide today are, in fact, the priority that we need through the crisis. I think that's really imperative. I think far too often in the fire service, we have a tendency to do what we have done in the past. And that may not necessarily work under our density or the dynamics of our city. So I think we have to really look at that first and look at what type of organizational analysis we have. Do we need to do business the same way that we've done it over the last 10 to 15 years? I think that's very important to look at. And I think if we need to make changes, what changes do need to be made? We'll all agree that emergency responses are primarily what we need to do. We need to get the apparatus to the citizens in order to protect them. But what can we outsource? You know, do we need to outsource? Do we need to have the level of public safety people across the board in fire prevention, EMS, or some of those, can they be outsourced with non-public safety people? Those are all questions. I'm not necessarily saying those are the answers, but I think those are the questions. And the other thing that we really have to ask ourselves, if we look pretty heavily at the mutual and automatic aid system, are we using it the way it was intended? You know, it was originally in California, it was established in the 1950s, and then it's been updated, of course, three times since then. But, you know, are we using it to its intent? And what is the economic impact through the automatic aid and mutual aid system affecting our surrounding jurisdictions? You know, I'm a very small city, for instance, so we, on a first alarm assignment, bring in way more units than we're able to provide on any given day. Is that fair to our surrounding jurisdiction? Is it really using the mutual aid system the way it was intended? I'll contend not, but the fire service in general, I will say we typically have a great attitude and mentality of how can I help you in a crisis. So where it becomes our downfall, I believe, in economic times is where the political officials, for instance, will turn around and say, you know, you're adding equipment, just get it from your surrounding jurisdictions. Well, over the decade, our surrounding jurisdictions are impacted because of the density and so forth. So are we using it correctly? Can we pull those resources in? I think all of that needs to be analyzed, and then we need to prioritize how we're going to make changes, because I agree with both Augie and Gary that if we don't, we're looking at reductions of services, and if that's the case, the only people that in fact suffer is the community itself, and then what we'll create is an outcry, and the outcry isn't going to be the one that we want, and in fact, we're going to be looked at to provide more with less, and because what they really want to see is us at their door. So we got to look at the response time. So I don't think there's any set answer, but I think we do have to be careful, and we do have to look at the organizational analysis within our organizations to come up with a regional perspective on how we're going to deal with this, because what affects one jurisdiction is going to have a direct effect on the surroundings.
Okay. Something that we're doing in San Diego County, in fact, all three of us are part of it, is regionalization on multiple levels. One is we're looking at consolidation between dispatch services. Heartland Communications is working with Gary's Communications Center to see if we can link them up so that we can be each other's backup system. We're looking at Cal Fire and see if we can build one big box for the Heartland area and Cal Fire. None of us can afford to build our own facilities, so even maintaining dispatch services, we want to make sure we cap the cost on those services so we can afford other services that are essential to our citizens. So we're looking and scratching at all those types of things, and like we said earlier, there's no one answer, there's multiples.
And I think Augie's really hit on it. I think that's the future for us. Especially here in San Diego County, we're already looking at the dispatch centers. There are several departments in San Diego County who are looking at what we have coined functional consolidation, and essentially we're sharing services within the department. We have a couple of departments who are sharing battalion chiefs, on-duty battalion chiefs, and I think that's really the future, because the fact remains is that the community continues to expect more from government and does not want to pay for it. They just don't get the linkage there between the cost of services and then the actual service delivery. And so they're really not going to look for us to be reducing services. And when they see that happening, they're going to start looking for some answers. And one of the things that I think we have to do, one of our obligations, is to make sure that we've explored all the things that Kim talked about earlier. And one of those things is functional consolidation. How can we share resources to better maximize the efficiencies within each of the departments? And I think that's really the future for all the departments. I think it's really acute here in San Diego, but I think across the country that's going to have to happen. One of the roadblocks that we have with that, though, obviously, is a lot of fire chiefs become very proprietary about their department, and you know they really don't want to dance to that tune, and that's unfortunate. But I think that really that is the trend of the future.
But you know, Gary, there's some good news in that too. 2 years ago, in East County, La Mesa, Lemon Grove, National City, San Miguel, Imperial Beach, and Chula Vista, we were interested in how to improve our medical quality assurance, quality improvement programs, and get a stronger oversight over our paramedic systems, because none of us could afford to do it right together or singularly. So we got together and formed what's called the Regional Cooperative Care Partnership. And it's not costing any of us a dime out of our base budgets. We pass the cost on to the consumer through ambulance transport fees, and now we have our own doctor, our own nurse, our own program coordinator, our own trainers, all of which we couldn't have afforded on our own. So it's another way to establish partnerships, and I think more and more, because of this economic crisis, we're going to be reaching out to our neighbors trying to find out, hey, I've got this problem, you've got this problem. How do we solve it together? And we'll link together. Even if, you know, I agree with you 100%, the proprietary issues, the ownership, the not wanting to give up local control is a big issue on consolidations especially. But I still think there's hope that we can make these other functional consolidations and business agreements to keep providing a high level of service.
Yeah, you know, and that all works. And the problems that we have, I see that as it comes about, both Gary's department and Vista and Coronado's being transport agencies, we put a whole new twist on it. But you can still, in fact, the way, what as Augie was saying, make it work. I mean, some CSAs have worked, been really well, and so forth. The consolidation issue is one that has been around since I was hired in the 70s. We were going to have a regional department then, and you remember that, Augie, way back then. And they told us it was going to be 5 years in the 70s, and we'd all be one. And here we are at 2009, and I think we're better than we were, actually, in so many ways. The other issue that it comes with, as Gary stated, you have a certain amount of fire chiefs. Fortunately, I should say, the three of us aren't one of those fire chiefs. We're all regionally tied to consolidating. But you do have those power pushes within, and people want to keep what they have and that fear factor. But at the same token, it goes community-wide, too. Our community is very fearful of losing what they see on the side of their fire engine showing up. They're very comfortable. They know that's where their tax dollar goes. They want it there, and they want to see what they own. So the educational process in just your community alone is a huge undertaking to get them to buy into the process, because there's nothing that moves, and we've all seen it and dealt with it. Nothing stops anything faster is a small group of people in front of a city council or a board telling you they don't want it, and then your political officials are looking at their political light bulb to be turned off and have a tendency to change their mind. So, you know, that's that we all see that. So I think we have to put a very extensive effort to, in fact, do public education and make sure that happens. And we saw that just in November on the tax initiative that we were looking at in this county and why it failed.
Well, I think if you look around the country, some of the consolidations that have happened, and I'm not really saying that we're going to be consolidating here anytime soon, but they were really driven by the inability to provide service because of lack of funding. And I think with this economic crisis, I think that this is going to be the time. I mean, this is a golden opportunity to step up and say this is the time to bring services together and regionalize what we can to reduce the costs, because there's going to be a strong driver behind the councils that is saying we don't have the money to do that anymore, and find another way to do it. And so I think that is this is a good opportunity for us.
Well, and this is where I think to make all of this happen, and, you know, the main focus on this question is really how do you maintain the level of service? You know, consolidations, better mutual aid between neighboring jurisdictions. But how do we make it happen? I think labor's got to come with us to the table and help resolve those issues. When we consolidated with East County, it started with labor. Did the labor groups want to make it happen? If they want to make it happen, then it led to the elected officials wanting to make it happen, and then things started to really move positively in that direction. I think we're all going to have to partner with labor to make sure that we, however we do it, can maintain these service levels, because we're not going to be doing it without them, because you know, you got the cost of benefits, you got the cost of retirement systems, you've got the cost of delivering the basic service, you've got growth. I know all of us are seeing growth in our response numbers, so how do we handle that? I mean, it's not just maintaining the level of service, it's how do you meet the growing demand for service. So balancing revenue, employee costs, service costs, and then tying in the regionalization issues and improving mutual aid are all going to have to be done in concert with each other to make it happen.
Well, and San Diego County is unique. And to start with, Loggy, and you're so right on this, too, we're inundated with a lot of little, really small agencies, mine being one of them, in fact. You know, it's a two-station department. And there's numerous departments that are single stations. And, you know, we get back to how do we really attack the problem, and do we start with contracting management services first to eliminate and blend, maybe, as one might say, the management overhead, and maybe that paves the way. And then how do you blend those one station departments into either a consolidated effort, JPA, whatever we decide, is a target. And it's just so hard to overcome that, I think, that political influence of loss of control. We've tried numerous things, and I think we got to keep trying, and I think we get better by taking a little bite out of the pie at a time. But the single departments, you know, including my own, sometimes you have to ask, you know, how efficient are you when your first alarm assignment's requiring four engines, a truck, and a medic unit, and a division chief, and your organization's able to provide that single one fire engine? And if you look at that impact on their surrounding, as the economy gets worse, the impact to utilize the mutual aid and auto aid system, I think, is going to get harder. So I agree with everybody. We in fact do have to use this economic times to our benefit, but it's got to come in combination with a very well thought out educational program for the community, so they in fact understand what's going to go, and then watch them tear it in, if you may, even through managerial services, and then in fact getting into almost a different type of restructuring of automatic aid. Because when you're talking automatic aid and it says like resources, how do you justify bringing three engines and a truck in your city or jurisdiction, and what about that is a like resource? So I think we have to change the mentality in general before we're going to get real success. I think it's a multi-year tier.
You know, you brought up something that we just touched on, but I agree with the concept that you were working towards is community education and community self-help programs. We just, from the San Diego County Fire Chiefs Association, had a press conference yesterday where we said we do not endorse stay and defend. Leave early, evacuate early. But as we have this
vegetation,
the urban interface area, you know, the wildland fires, wind-driven, fueled events. But my point is that there are never going to be enough firefighters to do that level of job. So that's the other thing we've got to look at. How do we provide the best level of service to the communities during these large-scale disasters? And the only way we can do it is not to cut our public education funds and to get out there and prepare the community, have them be better prepared than they are right now. That's the other piece that has to go on, even in tough economic times.
because we can't do it ourselves. I mean, we can do all the mutual aid, we can consolidate all we want, and we're still not going to be able to meet the community needs during the large disasters. We've seen it in 2003 and 2007, and that's the other part of the mix. The community themselves, their own responsibilities.
Well, you know, we're in a tough spot in the fire service in general. If you look at other disasters throughout the United States, and I'm very supportive of that philosophy of don't stay and defend, just move out. If you look at different disasters, whether it be a tornado or it be a flood, for instance, everybody will turn around and you go, leave your home, let the disaster happen, and then come back and mitigate the emergency. In the fire, the expectation of the public is, in fact, from their fire service, is you stand and defend my home. It's one of the few actual natural disasters, if you look at, that they want us to sit there in disaster versus leave, let the fire take its course or control that course. And I'm not advocating that necessarily we do it. I'm just simply saying that it's a public perception in this type of disaster that we actually stay on that front line and do whatever we can to battle it. And as we've seen over the last 2003-2007, until nature wants to quit taking its course, that's very difficult for us to do that. So, you know, it really is huge on a public education atmosphere, on doing regionalization or blending of managerial resources or just consolidation of departments. But it has to take place. And the education has to not only be with your public, it's got to be strong with boards and city council within our department, because city managers are good at what they do, and we respect that. But they will use the fact that we make things work to the advantage, and it's a total prioritization of the system has to change.
You know, Gary, there's something that just came up that you're heavily involved in is public-private partnerships right now. We just had a multi-million dollar bid go out for CAD-to-CAD link of all the fire CAD systems in San Diego County. City of Vista was the one that was coordinating that effort, and we managed as a region with Homeland Security dollars to craft a public-private partnership. We're going to reap the rewards of a national model in CAD-to-CAD linkage and management. That's coming out, in the next 4 to 6 weeks? The bid will be let. And that's another thing that we as fire chiefs and elected officials can do to ensure that we can continue to sustain our operations on our critical services like dispatch, is when large dollar bids are out there, don't just bid it out. Squeeze the vendors as much as you can and get them in as a partner so that you get some sort of a return on your initial investment.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you, Augie. The public-private partnership concept is really going to serve us very well here in San Diego County. There's one other piece, too, that might help us to maintain the same level of service to some degree, and we're going to have to work with labor to sort all this out, but we have a huge resource out there in our CERT teams. And North County Fire, for example, they have like 400 CERT team members.
Wow.
And after a fire is knocked down, they go in, and they're part of the service crew that puts those things back in place. And so I think, but there's a real strong reluctance to a lot of paid departments, career departments, to have CERT members in there as volunteers, because it's a real uncomfortable situation for them. And I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but I think that is a real that's a huge potential for us to tap into in the future to help provide service levels to the community that right now we're really underutilizing them.
And that same thing, you know, talk about, volunteerism. You know, we've got a reserve program in San Miguel, and I know that El Cajon started one, 2 years ago?
2 years ago, that's correct.
And I think La Mesa's looking at one. And they don't take jobs away from existing firefighters. They don't replace full-time paid firefighters. But, boy, the surge capacity that you have with those additional personnel during the large catastrophic fires or disasters is huge, right up there with the CERT teams.
Absolutely.
I think you're right on that. How do we better manage those?
What do those teams do? What,
What involvement do they have during this?
Our reserve firefighters go through the full fire academy. They're certified firefighters. They do not take the place of the constant staffing, three-person staffing, but they have to volunteer X number of shifts a month as the fourth person on an engine company or on our truck company.
Okay. Yeah, so, the CERT is actually community emergency response teams, and those are actually citizens within your community, and they're taught through multiple models on what to do, and then they actually are designed to take care of small blocks within the community in the case of a natural disaster. The benefit, for instance, Gary is right on. It's an incredibly untapped resource. They tapped into just a little bit in the 2003 fires when I was at the command post, and it was amazing the outcry that came and the response that they got off of them, and they were able to totally, due to the community training, give them a task, and really in essence with little oversight at all. They're great for evacuations, they're great for resource centers, distribution of equipment centers. They were logistically, it was just great to have. And then they break down into specific tasks, and they go out on their own, and then they check in on certain times. So it's a real benefit. And I agree with both of you guys. It's an incredible resource we need to hit.
And the great thing about a CERT team is that not only do they help you logistically within the department, but they are your best sales force out there in the public to say, you know, here's what's going on in the fire department, folks. Here's the shortages that they have. Here's the fiscal issues that they're dealing with. And, you know, you're talking neighbor to neighbor, and it just doesn't get any better than that.
You know, Gary, I just sat down with the Red Cross yesterday. They've got $1 million that's unspent from the 2007 fires and donations, and they're actually looking at doing something similar to what you're recommending, making dollars available to expand CERT teams so that they will be able to work the evacuation centers for the Red Cross and establish those centers in conjunction with the Red Cross. And that's the thing, is getting the purpose for the CERT program. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be sending some information out on that here pretty soon.
And I really do think that's going to grow, because at the county level is trying to figure out how and where to implement them in the Emergency Operations Center and how to get them out to the county emergency evacuation center. So I think between the two, it's going to be a really good blend and take off. And the fact that you can get federal funding for it is going to be incredible.
You know, the one thing we didn't talk about, though, is we've spent all these monies on Homeland Security dollars. We bought a lot of technology, mobile data computers, automatic vehicle locators, GIS systems. And in certain parts of the county, we've activated AVL, automatic vehicle, send the closest available unit, but we haven't done that countywide. And we've talked about it in Heartland, of actually just dropping the borders on a test and see what happens to responses, who covers who. And maybe one of the things we'd find, if we can ever get to that point and activate that system fully countywide, is that instead of needing more fire stations, the ones that have capacity that can cross the border, instead of that jurisdiction that needs another fire station, maybe they pay the smaller fee to have the responses go back across.
And I think that's the key. I really get back to, not to belabor the point, but, you know, once you do your organizational analysis, whether it's your department or by a zone wide, you know, whether it be standards of coverage or whatever it may be, looking at it, you're able to do that. And I think you need to start that. And maybe that's the happy medium in between the total consolidation. Maybe you get in to the blending of managerial services across borders from smaller agencies, and then in fact you get fees for service coming in, whether it be, you know, for instance, San Diego City's hurt arson strike team coming into your investigations, or whether it's the cost per another apparatus coming in. But we really, if we're going to do that, we really have to look at the mutual and auto aid system. Both you and I, Augie, sat in a meeting, what was it, last week. We got the pin back in the grenade, I think, from the county having a little bit of an issue with our mutual and auto aid system. And it, everybody's dedication in that meeting was just an incredible example of everybody wanting to work together to make it work. And everything worked out very, very well. But we got to look into that. How do we meet the needs of the mutual aid, but still have the ability for automatic aid without providing organizations to circumvent the intent. Mm-hmm. I think I really, you know, because of the way we do things is I'll be glad to give you anything I have at any given time. We do have a tendency to circumvent, and it's one that comes back and hurts us sometimes. Sometimes we're our own worst enemy there.
Okay, well, gentlemen, thank you. That's some great insight, and obviously you guys have worked together before, so this is working out pretty well. All three of you were Chiefs for 30 years. You still look very good, so I'm not saying you're older Chiefs, but...
Clean living.
See us in the morning when we get up.
Okay. succession planning, it's another thing that departments are looking at. And obviously the bigger cities have it a lot easier because they have the resources to help build a plant. Smaller cities, Chief Raddatz, you'll be the chief of a two-station city. So when it's time for you to hang up your hat, what are you guys doing as far as succession planning, and when do you start, or did you start, or you know what is succession planning to you in your department?
Well, our department actually, and I think probably the three departments here have some form of succession planning. We have it in place, and it took us 5 years to get there for a small agency. And it, you know, there's a couple steps. We'll address when really does it start. And I can only speak on behalf of our organization, but it's my opinion. It starts the minute an employee's hired. You start it there, and it starts with the orientation down to the recruit academy. It starts down to understanding of the simple things of policies and procedures. It's guidelines, and it's much more than simply a task book. A task book is an easy way to do things. Succession planning doesn't have to be expensive, but it is time-consuming. And you look at it from your firefighter. You look at it for your, whether it be an engineer's preparation course that teaches their basic identification of education they need for a position, down to teaching them that technical knowledge, down to teaching them the manipulative skills, testing them for that. That's what we do. And then you go to your captains. We run a 15-week captain's college. It sounds longer and harder than it is. It actually only meets once a week because it was easier to do that and give assignments for that 5 hours once a week for 15 weeks. And it was fiscally obtainable that way. And then, you know, they have a task book. They're instructors come in both citywide, outside of our department. City manager comes in and gives the expectations of a city. Human resources comes in and talks about it. Risk management comes in. All of those items take place. And then we have our battalion chiefs. We call it a battalion chief boot camp. And it teaches you political astuteness and budgetary items that pick up from the captain's college. So we start with budgets very early on, and we bring them through our organization. Those are almost your laid out plans, but succession planning is, I believe, is so much more than that. It's the little things that you're willing to do as a fire chief that really bring people along for the succession plannings. It's turning around to a division chief or a battalion chief and say, you know what, I need you to come to a city council meeting and rotate them out. You can learn so much from those types of meetings and explaining the dynamics of your city, what to watch for, what not to watch for instance. And that growth is valuable. So I think it really boils down to a structured plan for all ranks throughout the organization. I think it takes an incredible amount of dedication and willingness on the fire chief to allow it to happen, because it doesn't have to be expensive, but it is incredibly time-consuming. And I think both Augie and Gary will agree, it impacts your workload that is already pretty large. And then I think the other thing that people have a tendency to forget is succession planning is they limit it to the fire service. You've got to branch it out. You know, the administrative secretary at the front office, that next step is maybe a management analyst. You have to include that too, because everybody within the organization establishes and needs that. that growth in order to be successful. And when you get it going, it's an incredible morale builder. And you will actually change. I think you'll change the culture of the organization in the process of doing it. That's kind of how we do it in Coronado. But it took us 5 years to get there.
I agree with Kim. We've got that was the first project we tackled when I came to San Miguel, the rank and file. Whether it was uniform or non-uniform, said, hey, we want to be able to compete for the job. We don't want to outsource promotional opportunities. And we got with labor. We established a five-step succession planning program, but it's much more than that. Like Kim said, it's really an employee development program. What I found, because I did the same thing in San Diego, we did a mentoring program there, and I brought that here to San Miguel. If you have peer mentors as part of the program, where people can ask the stupid question and not feel any ramifications from it, if you give people the ability to take risk in their careers, to stretch out, take on stretch projects, to go where they haven't gone before, raise the bar on the employee, challenge them a little bit, and then reward them. Part of our program in San Miguel isn't just developing the plan, implementing it, and revising it, but we've actually incentivized the employee. They get 2% for an AA, 2% for a BA, and 2% for a master's, so they can get a 6% pay raise just for getting educated, and it's all perishable. That's a heck of an incentive. But we've also, like Kim said, branched out our succession planning and our career development to our non-uniform employees. Right now, we're mentoring one of our civilian personnel, taking her from a task position she had before and seeing how she fits into an HR manager position. But every position knows what they have to do. We've showed them what we're willing to do as an organization, and it's listed by position what we will do for the employee. But then there's another list that the employee has to take the responsibility for themselves. So, you know, our board of directors has a responsibility to fund it. Kim's right. There's a cost to everything. The management staff has a obligation to do the work and put the effort into it and sustain the program. And the individual employee has a responsibility to carry it out. And when it all works together, it's a beautiful thing. The problem without a succession planning program is failure of an organization. And when you lose the corporate knowledge, when you don't breed new ideas and you maintain status quos, an organization doesn't grow. And we've seen what happened with the auto industry on that. You know, the fire service can't be that 100 years of tradition unencumbered by progress. You got to breed that that ability to grow and develop and be creative in your people. And succession planning programs do that.
Well, you know, for us, we're a little bit different than you guys. We're probably a little bit behind you guys. We have a mentoring program. It's a pretty sophisticated mentoring program that works really well. And we're in a development process for each of the ranks in terms of what they really need to achieve and those kinds of things. But one of the things that we see that is a real challenge for us, and I don't know if you all are seeing this, is that with our retirement system at 3 at 50, by the time you get somebody ready to go, they're out the door. And you may have a year or two as a fire chief and they're ready to retire. And that's a real issue for us in the state of California, and I'm not sure what the answer to that is. You know, the other thing is that you have to have a city manager, especially if you're doing an internal succession plan. You know, the city manager has to know, has to have some confidence in the folks that you're working on, or else they're going to have to be looking someplace else, and then you're going to lose that whole brain trust there. So it's a holistic approach, and I have to confess that we're not there yet. You know, I need to figure out a way to bring in my boss and her bosses, the council, and how do we get some kind of a strategic approach to getting somebody in the chute, online, and in the mix, so that 3 or 4 years down the road, they're going to be able to stay within the organization with some level of certainty. Otherwise, you know, I'm not sure the incentive is there. And then sometimes it's healthy for an organization to bring in somebody from the outside. I mean, I know from my perspective, I've been the outside guy 2 out of 3 times, it has been a shot in the arm for the organization because they've had inside folks. So, I mean, it can sometimes be beneficial to bring somebody in from the outside, or maybe having that strategic or that succession planning process focused on sending somebody outside and not stay inside.
Well, you want to know what interesting thing? It just dawned on me. What if you talk about consolidation and the blending, maybe the hot ticket is not to reinvent the wheel. Maybe we look at what works well for Augie and San Miguel, what works well in Coronado, a 15-week captain's college, and maybe we blend it and we bring it regionally. Mm-hmm. And that way, in essence, we encompass succession planning for a region and each department joins, and it becomes easier.
But succession planning just isn't for the chief officer.
Succession planning is for,
like Kim said earlier, it's how do you take that new employee, make him the best employee possible, and if that employee's got an eye to be an engineer or a captain someday.
Exactly.
So you've got different levels of it. Right now, we're working on three levels in San Miguel. We've got the one that takes the reserve to a full-time firefighter, to an engineer, to a captain. Then we've got the other component that develops a captain into a chief officer, then a chief officer into whatever they want to do. And we're even working on a transition approach to where, well, even if the opportunity doesn't pop up here, how do you become a marketable asset as a chief officer outside of the organization? Mm-hmm. So we're working on that. And I think the other part is let's not forget to focus on the civilian side of it, our administrative staff, our clerical, human resources, the finance staff. When we lose that corporate knowledge without backing it up, it hurts us. So that's got to be in the mix.
Well, you know, the other real quick thing, and I think they go hand in hand. I think it's very hard to do succession planning without first strategic planning.
Yes,
I think it's almost impossible to do those. So if you do have a well laid out strategic plan that runs 3 to 5 years, then your succession plan in essence will follow into it. And that's how we sold our city manager on it. We said, here's what we can do for strategic planning. Here's what we can do in succession planning. And of course, the first subject that came up is how much is this going to cost our city? And when we turned around and looked at our captain's college, the cost to put that on, in fact, hard dollars, was less than $3,000. But the time put into it, which was incredibly time-consuming, we were able to spread out through the strategic plan. So I think you almost have to put them hand in hand, and when you do that, it works out pretty well.
Oh, you're right. That succession plan, that's where we sold ours. It's one of our core initiatives in the strategic plan. So my board of directors bought in on it, and when we showed them the budget for that, and it's not much. Our whole budget for this whole thing is only $12,000 a year. But we get a lot done, and that includes consultant costs coming in and doing some of our things like 360-degree feedbacks, and in some cases, one-on-one coaching and development where people have, you know, a rough edge that really needs something with an expertise outside of the organization.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're the same way. Ours is in our strategic plan, and which is actually we're getting ready to redo that again. But it's been very slow to bring about and to evolve because we like I say, we've got the ranks going, but when you get up in the chief officer area, that's been a challenge for us, and I think that's been a challenge for a lot of departments in terms of how do you get folks to a certain level and retain them, and then move them into your spot when you leave, and I think that's a challenge for a lot of folks.
Okay, Chief, so thank you very much. We had Chief Gary Fisher from Vista, Chief Augie Gio from San Miguel, and Chief Kim Raditz from Coronado. Gentlemen, thank you very much, and we'll see if we can put together another session here and continue on with what we spoke about today. Thank
Great.
You, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.